striving to be happy gives my life meaning. And that means living in the now, the present moment, because the concept of happiness is always in flux. So you have to be willing to adapt and change.
He was two floors below, she was two floors above. The kind of first meet you dream of. Christmas Day, 12 times a year, sisters wait to stay near. Just one of the many. Show you how to be just as you are. Perfect and complete, every broken heart. Spirit embodied from the start. Only now, be here only now.
So ever since then, I don't have a fear of dying. And I think that's why I don't have a fear of being with people who are dying. Because I know that what they're probably seeing or experiencing is, there's no words to describe it.
Strong women before and after they came, through each lifetime to the physical plane. The magic extends beyond her from daughter to daughter. Two dishes is all you need, my friend. He said it's my time, time has no end. Surrounded by infinity, she knew back then. Let her show you how to be just as you are. Perfect and complete with every scar. Spirit embodied from the start.
Learning to love one another without conditions, that's a biggie. Because love is the only thing we can take away with us when we do pass from this world. It's the only thing. Finally, when in doubt, go within, breathe, give it to spirit, and let it go.
Life is for the living, carry on. Life is for the living, carry on.
That's Sarah McInnes. Only Now from the Legacy Song Project, Atlantic Chapter. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. Film theory meets film music in Synesthesia. In June 2023, Sarah McInnes released Threads, eight original songs based on the stories of eight Atlantic Canadians, four at the end of their life and four who have lost loved ones. The album is accompanied by a short documentary film by Nova Scotia filmmakers Ali Kelly and Pat Lepadwin-Devin. I saw this film at the recent Reframe Film Festival last weekend. It follows the conversations with the participants that Sarah interviewed to create the songs. Sarah McInnes is a songwriter, music therapist, and end-of-life doula. And the Atlantic Chapter explores death, dying, grief, loss, and love through the transformational lenses of documentary film and songwriting. And I caught the live performance with Sarah McInnes on stage at Showplace last weekend that accompanied the screening. I'm going to play another track from the album Threads. And this one is called To the Water.
I feel a little bit like I am jumping into the abyss, but I am totally okay that the bungee cord's going to save me. Like, that is like my faith. Like, what does that look like? Don't know. But that's how I feel a little bit about death in this way.
To the water, let my body feel the draw of ancient tides, eternal collide, wild and raw. All of her expressions, like a silent undertow, will bring you where you need and teach you how to let go of control.
Done a lot. I'm quite content.
A river doesn't struggle. It takes the path of least resistance, not a fight to survive. It thrives in quiet persistence, bending where it needs to, in perpetual motion, a journey every river takes to make it down.
Get it right away. I love the family being around me. I've been very lucky in that I do not have any qualms around that I am loved.
Crest reaches its peak, the curling light refracts like a life complete. No soul can cheat. The ocean calls the water back.
We're all waves that are coming in on the ocean, and we crash on the seashore, and then the individual wave is gone, but the water's not gone. The water just gets reabsorbed into the sea. And that's the collective. That's all of us. It's the wave's most beautiful moment. And I'm curious about that. Is there eternal life? Well, maybe that feels like an eternity.
I met Sarah McInnes all the way back in 2007 through a project headed by Charlie Glasspool. It was called 3C84, and I accompanied live performances with video projections, and I documented the recording session and provided images for the CD release. And I did a few music videos for 3C84 as well, including Alien, Yuri Gagarin's Lullaby, Let's See What My Telescope Says, and Sarah McInnes' guest vocal for When I Was Dead is actually my favorite video of them, of the lot. And it was written by Charlie Glasspool, and the video that I recorded was a live performance by Sarah McInnes on Saturday, May 26, 2007, at the Peterborough Museum in Peterborough, Ontario, and fireworks unexpectedly went off in the background, and beautiful and perfectly timed near the end of her song. So listen for that. So I didn't, you know, stop the camera or turn the camera around. For the video of the live performance, I added stock footage of fireworks later to sync up to the sound. And coincidentally, the song is also about death, after death. And it's kind of told from the perspective, it is told from the perspective of the one who died. This is When I Was Dead.
When I was dead, when I was
Directing starts not when the script is being discussed with the writer, nor during the work with the actor or with the composer, but at the time when before the interior gaze of the person making the film and known as the director, there emerges an image of the film. This might be a series of episodes worked out in detail, or perhaps the consciousness of an aesthetic texture, an emotional atmosphere to be materialized on screen. He starts to be an artist at the moment when, in his mind or even on film, his own distinctive system of images starts to take shape. His own pattern of thoughts about the external world and the audience are invited to judge it, to share with the director in his most precious and secret dreams. Only when his personal viewpoint is brought in, when he becomes a kind of philosopher, does he emerge as an artist and cinema as an art. Why do people go to the movies? I think that what a person normally goes to the cinema for is time. For time lost or spent, not yet had. He goes there for living experience, for cinema. Like no other art widens, enhances, and concentrates a person's experience. And not only enhances it, but makes it longer, significantly longer. That is the power of cinema. Stars, storylines, and entertainment have nothing to do with it. The cinema image, then, is basically observation of life's facts within time, organized according to the pattern of life itself and observing its time laws. One of the binding and immutable conditions of cinema is that actions on the screen have to develop sequentially, regardless of the fact of being conceived as simultaneous or retrospective of what have you. I want to make the point yet again that in film, every time, the first essential in any plastic composition, its necessary and final criterion is whether it is true to life, specific and factual. That is what makes it unique. By contrast, symbols are born and readily pass into general use to become cliches. When an author hits upon a particular plastic composition, ties it with some mysterious turn of thought of his own, loads it with extraneous meaning. I've been reading words written by Andrei Tarkovsky, the Soviet filmmaker who made Stalker from 1979, and we're listening to music by Edward Artemyev, Edward Artemyev, from the soundtrack for Stalker, 1979, by Andrei Tarkovsky. I've been reading from his chapter called Imprinted Time. Quoted in the New York Times in 2019, director Martin Scorsese gained fame by saying, "Marvel movies aren't cinema." The director of such movies as Taxi Driver and Goodfellas said, "Cinema is an art form that brings you the unexpected. In superhero movies, nothing is at risk," he said. In The Guardian in the same year, he said, "Honestly, the closest I can think of them as well made as they are, with actors doing the best they can under the circumstances, is theme parks. It isn't the cinema of human beings trying to convey emotional, psychological experiences to another human being." According to the newspaper, the head of Marvel, Kevin Feige, responded to the criticism by saying, "Maybe it's easy to dismiss VFX or flying people or spaceships or billion-dollar grosses, but," he notes, "Alfred Hitchcock never won Best Director, so it doesn't mean anything." He said, "I would much rather be in a room full of engaged fans." They are arguing about the main principle or intent behind the film's production. One filmmaker prioritizes conveying emotional and psychological human experiences, while the other strings one show-stopping cinema trickery after another with a thin storyline. I think it's funny that this so-called Marvel movie might have originated somewhere on a beach in Hawaii in the late 1970s. True story. George Lucas and Steven Spielberg ran into each other at the Mauna Kea Beach Hotel while trying to escape the commotion from their recent successes, Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And according to the famous story, they both sat on the beach and talked while building a sandcastle. Lucas and Spielberg, sitting on a beach, both in their 30s, at the height of their careers, were naturally talking about their following projects. And from what I remember of the story, Lucas asked Spielberg what kind of movie he wanted to see. They spoke of their childhood love of old adventure serials from the 1930s and 1940s, from which Star Wars came. And Spielberg said he secretly wanted to direct a James Bond film. And Lucas told him about his concept for an adventure film with an Indiana Smith character. Spielberg loves the idea and calls it a James Bond film without the hardware, but tells Lucas the last name Smith doesn't sound right. Lucas replies, "Okay." What about Jones? We'll be right back. Clearly, in some sense, recent spectacle cinema has reaffirmed its roots in stimulus and carnival rides in what might be called the Spielberg-Lucas-Coppola cinema of effects. And so even then, their names are tied to the blockbuster cinema. Popular lore credits the movie Bratz of the new American cinema as the fathers of the blockbuster film. And it's become an accepted history, despite cinema having pursued high budget and lavish spectacles long before that. But as Paul Risker writes in Little White Lies, his blog, the technological limitations of the 70s and 80s, while far from perfect, imbued the world building with a certain improvised hands-on aesthetic. And this is a world away from today's use of computer-generated imagery and green and blue screens, which purport to increase immersion, but in reality feel more artificial. And once films mimicked our physical play, and now technology has allowed them to appear as dreams, almost without limitation. From Star Wars and Spielberg's Jurassic Park to Marvel and DC superhero films, the sole focus is no longer on creative storytelling and the cinematic experience, but on the diversification of revenue. Let's listen to more of John Williams' work. This is the theme, of course, to the most iconic, one of the most iconic themes of all time in cinema. His theme for, well, you guess it.
Thank you.
That was Jaws by John Williams. And before that, we heard Raiders of the Lost Ark. According to philosopher Immanuel Kant, the judgment of taste is not an intellectual judgment and so not logical, but is aesthetic, which means that that is one whose determining ground cannot be other than subjective. Art and criticism cooperate, says A.O. Scott, through a kind of symbiosis that often seems to marginalize or do away with the need for an audience of non-professional, unspecialized, agendaless spectators. The motives that bring us to the box office window are often casual, even banal. But the transformative, galvanic result of the experience was not willed or anticipated, says Scott. And yet, he continues, somehow it happens. Your everyday perception is disrupted by the sense of a presence that is hard to describe but impossible to deny. This is how art speaks to us, says Scott. This is the challenge that reverberates through the exhibition halls. It changed my life. Scott does not provide any examples. He reflects that it could just be a figure of speech, and also a hyperbolic way of acknowledging the momentarily disruptive impact of art on the equilibrium of everyday consciousness. And he admits that the nature and mechanism of the transformation, how did your life change exactly, what was the difference before and after, rarely receive much analysis. For myself, I learned from the actions of the people on screen in a similar way that I do in real life. For example, I learned how to make French toast from Dustin Hoffman in a scene from Kramer versus Kramer. I learned from convincing displays of information. Friends of mine turned vegetarian after seeing the film Forks Over Knives, 2011, a documentary examination of the reversal of degenerative diseases through the rejection of our present menu of animal-based and processed foods. Tears, of course, says Scott, are a traditional measure of aesthetic response. Palpable evidence that a work of art has reached beyond the shell of its own existence or the clouded bubble of its creator's intentions and made an impact in the world. I have heard countless of times as a way of giving me a compliment on a film that I made, the words, "You made me cry." I remember crying at spectacles of sublimity, like when I saw Van Gogh's Crows Over the Wheat Field in a museum in Amsterdam, or when I saw the shot of Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun, 1987, of him walking through a field while boxes parachute down around him. This memory is twice cherished since I recall Mr. Wayne Sargent, my high school teacher at the time, happened to be coincidentally sitting next to me at the movie theater, and when he saw my tears, he blurted, "I love you," involuntarily in the dark. We're listening to music by John Williams. This is from Empire of the Sun, Exultate Justi. For myself, seeing Jaws, 1975, as a child had a profound and lasting effect on me about the power of cinema. As I remember this story now after so many tellings, I discover a new metaphor. As a boy, I approached the screen as my mother urged, but then I got too close and got burned. So I ran back to mommy. After the humiliation of being heard screaming by the entire movie theater, I may have had that same reaction as any aesthete, as Scott suggests, with, I want to do that. How did he do that? Maybe I can do better. At 7 years old, I did not have the means to try to do better. I worked through my ideas by playing with my toys and reenacting scenes from movies I'd seen while playing soundtracks, movie soundtracks. Someday I'll be a film director, I told myself. But when I learned in film school that I had to play a social game to achieve this, I balked. By seeing Sans Soleil by Chris Marker, it changed my life by showing me how to make a film outside of the Hollywood gates on my own with the resources that I have. My life literally changed because starting then, I made different choices and chose to walk previously unseen paths. While reading Nancy Schwartz's paper, I remember that Walter Murch edited THX 1138, and I recall a story I had read about the making of the film. From what I remember, director George Lucas had apparently asked Murch to create a soundtrack to which he would supply the images. The story goes that the resulting experiment led to making of the THX 1138. The book that Michael Ondaatje wrote sits on my shelf. I flipped through the book quickly, looking for the story to cite. It could be in another book that I read. Instead, I find a brief passage about the translation of a three-dimensional object, the human face, into a two-dimensional photograph. Murch says, there's chemistry between each actor and a certain lens. I remember George Lucas being fascinated by the depth of Robert Duvall's features, his deep-set eyes and rounded forehead. It was one of the reasons he cast Duvall. I flip through the book again and find this from George Lucas. Sound was very important to us. In THX 1138, we decided we would create a soundtrack that was primarily sound effects-based. The music would operate like sound effects, and the sound effects would operate like music. Yet I find the following quote intriguing. In school, I was very much an anti-story, anti-character kind of guy. I was of the San Francisco avant-garde film school and cinema verite, that sort of thing. The quote, I think, supports my theory of Star Wars and the conceit of starting the film with the words Episode 4, as one of the most avant-garde gestures in Hollywood blockbuster history. I have been wondering for a while if my thoughts on the conscientious reversal of the genre of film noir to its opposite, film blanc, as I've written elsewhere. What if, instead of cynicism, there was hope? Instead of showing situations where humans are being unkind to other humans, what if a film insists on showing kindnesses? Instead of showing the dark side of human nature, what if it tells the story of how we can find the light in every situation? Are we ready? Film blanc may seem overbearing in its optimism, but couldn't we say the same heavy-handedness about film noir? Our current mediascape has been overrun by visions of dystopia. A cursory glance at the front page of Netflix on any day gives me an idea. Human unkindness and dystopia are prominently on display. If there could be a unified, concerted movement to, quote, flatten the curve during the pandemic, then perhaps there could be a similar movement toward hacking the Netflix algorithm that determines what gets featured on the front page. After all, new types of battles are required for new wars. Specialty channels can, of course, offer an alternative, but we need a massive effort to tip the scale, or at least balance it. Schwartz notes that very few science fiction films have actually dealt with technological utopias, with the exception of Wells Corda Menzies' Things to Come in 1935. In J.P. Talat's paper, he outlines the problem with utopia. He starts by quoting Paul Ricoeur, who suggests ideology and utopia represent deviant attitudes towards social reality. Nostalgic escapism of utopian dystopian narratives is useful if it helps us to interrogate the prevailing conditions of our culture.
He makes a circle in the sky.
Ricoeur says our visions of utopias, or dystopias for that matter, produce a problematic relationship to our world because of their eclipse of praxis, in that such fantastic constructions, much like any culture's dominant ideology, can easily distract us from what might be done. For Paul Virilio, our world is inexorably becoming film. There is a widespread postmodern belief that reality itself has disappeared into a variety of cultural constructs, and that the real exists only as we construct it from experience, or as it is constructed for us by the many cinematic and electronic media that permeate our world. However fully imagined and convincing diegetic world of the imagined world undermine the critical effect of such a vision by dislocating this distinctly imagined world from our own. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. Check the show notes for the complete playlist and other links to media that I mentioned in today's episode. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. Film theory meets film music in Synesthesia. In the background, we're listening to Désert, the original motion picture soundtrack, Deserts, by Radwan Ghazi Mumne, Alexandre Saint-Ange, Andrew Bedouin, and Alexi Perry Cox. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.
He was just really, really caring and compassionate with people. He just brought joy to everybody that he was around.
I convinced him to watch the meteor shower with me, and we got to like just hang out on the blanket and talk, and yeah, that was a really good memory too.
Such a team player. Kyle was the one that, you know, if there was teammate on the floor, he was the first one to help them up. He was constantly talking them up. He probably knew more about basketball than most of the kids on his team because he like watched it all the time.
You loved the strategy.
A cloud passing Pedora Lake. The sunshine like your smile, it took the pain away. Brightening up like the night sky when the stars align. Or watching the shower, falling lights. And